Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, 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 everyone, and welcome to Spirit Therapy. Let's set the mood with this.
I got pushed like a tree, holding me down with my eyes on the sky, but my feet on the ground, and the people all come when they wanna gather round, cause they hear some distant sound. Let the sea jump in with me, tonight we leave in the streets we scream.
Yeah, that's Matus Yahoo with Freedom of Fire. Sorry, Fire of Freedom. Kind of the same thing to me. But anyway, yeah, fun song. That's just a little tidbit. Something about being strong like a tree. Let the freedom ring. It's always a good idea. So welcome, everyone. Welcome to some daylight savings time. Another hour of happy, happy, joy, joy, sunshine. Hallelujah. Think what you want about the daylight savings time and the Edison, which is a little ridiculous. Just a small point. I have to say that Tesla already figured it out where we didn't need to have that, and we can have that fun, fun, joy, joy, sunshine all the time. But anyway, at least we have it now, being thankful for the gifts and the present that we have. So speaking of the present, I always forget to introduce myself. My name is Nicole Tomasini. Hello, everyone. Buongiorno, buonasera. So speaking of what just happened and the present moment, Edward Snowden, who is responsible for, hallelujah, leaking what the NSA is doing with all the spying on us and stepping on our freedoms and our privacies, just did a, I'm pretty sure it's about, I don't know how long he talked, but a couple hours ago, he spoke at the NXSW, sorry, I don't know, so like that, that's what's happening with my tongue right now, the SXSW, say that time five times fast, calls for public oversight of U.S. spy programs. So my roommate informed me that this was happening, so I did a little Google search to find, you know, what was going on. And, you know, CNN has it on lockdown. I got to point it out, man. I mean, you go to CNN.com, first of all, you're going to watch like three commercials for like 2 minutes of content. And you have Wolf Meltzer, what's his name, that sends out this girl that's like 19 years old, like what is she, an intern, to cover the Snowden thing. And, you know, I mean, she says, you know, a lot. I say, you know, a lot. But I mean, you know, I'm not talking to 40 million people and trying to bring the message of Snowden. But see, they're not trying to bring the message of Snowden across. So, you know, she kind of told you what was going on. Not really. Not concisely. As you scroll down, CNN, these are the three videos that they have posted. These are the, what are they called? Taglines. The trick behind Snowden leaks revealed, which is really somehow about how he got the password from somebody, and they're trying to make it seem like, you know, he stole it or that they were coerced. Ridiculous that he didn't go to the Sochi Olympics, really, maybe because he didn't want to get shot. And the third one is Snowden is the worst spy in U.S. history. Like, so if you're telling me that that's not some biased news, I don't know what is. Amazing. Amazing. Anyway, so today we're talking about freedom versus virtue and freedom. So it was just very fitting that this is going on, that these things are coming out. Thank God for people like Snowden that are standing up for our rights and our freedoms and our freedom of speech and our right to know what's going on. And one of the big points that he made was there needs to be a publicly influenced, a public eye on what the government is doing. And with these programs, sure, you need to listen. I mean, we listen to what's going on in our neighborhood. You know, we want to listen to the world. Okay, we understand governments, you know, you all have secrets. But you know, where does it stop is the idea. So really, all Snowden's saying is this is what's happening and we need some regulation for it. And then he gets that kind of press. So anyway, there you go. Word to the wise. So let's see, virtue versus freedom. I did a lot of recognizance on this. I felt like I was writing a term paper, but it was fascinating looking at what different people thought about virtue. The word virtue, it always sounded like a good idea, like sort of a sweet peach on a high branch that you're never really going to get, something like that. I don't know what you think about it. But what is virtue? To me, I always thought of it also as like a woman's virtue. What's a woman's virtue? Well, something about chastity and, I don't know, like being on a pedestal or something. So I want to go through what some of our great thinkers over the past, some of them go that back to Plato and then Nietzsche and these people. So I thought we would go through and take a look at the idea of virtue and what does this mean. And then later on, we'll talk about women's rights and how women became property and how their property became part of a man if they married them. Very interesting. And then we'll talk about, we'll go to a little bit of Abraham, talking about freedom, a little funny story there. And something like that. I hope everyone in the northeast is enjoying this wonderful weather that we've been having lately. Just had to say that. It felt so good to have the sun on my face. Hallelujah. Spring is just around the corner. Very exciting. All right, so let's talk about virtue. Virtue is moral excellence. A virtue is a positive trait or quality deemed to be morally good and thus is valued as a foundation of principle and good moral being. And virtues are the opposite of vices, which has a lot to do with one of the pictures that you'll see by men. Dengya, the Tenya. I don't know. For some reason, my pronunciation today isn't the greatest. You'll figure it out. It's the one with all the people running around and you know, people in the clouds looking down, supervising. So in that painting, it's the virtues against the vices, basically. And we'll talk about what vices are. But in Plato's view, the four virtues are temperance, prudence, courage, and justice. And Plato stated that the separate virtues can't exist independently and offer an evidence the contradictions of acting with wisdom, yet in an unjust way, or acting bravery, yet without wisdom. Interesting. So it's, again, about the balance, very fitting for spirit therapy, and we'll continue. Let me wet my whistle a bit. Maybe I can get my tongue to go a little better. All right. So Aristotle talked about virtue as being a point between a deficiency and an excess of a trait. So he talks about a golden mean, that virtue lies not in the exact middle, but somewhere in between two extremes. So he explains virtue like this: at the right times, about the right things, towards the right people, for the right end, in the right way, is the immediate and best condition. This is proper to virtue. Interesting. This is not simply splitting the difference between two extremes. So, for example, generosity is a virtue that fits between the two extremes of not giving at all and giving foolishly or just without care and for no reason. And then generosity is the perfect mean between the two. So it hits in the right target. A further example is courage is the golden mean between cowardice and foolhardiness. Confidence is the golden mean between self-deprecation and vanity. And to find the golden mean requires common sense smarts, not just high intelligence. Aristotle's sense virtue is excellence at being human, a skill that helps a person survive, thrive, form meaningful relationships, and find happiness. Learning virtue is usually difficult at first, but becomes easier with practice over time until it becomes a habit. I think we can apply this to what we're all doing these days with learning a new way of working with the spirit, our spirit, the spirit of our community and the world, and also quieting our mind, everything that spirit therapy is about, anything that you do to quiet yourself and to become more balanced. Of course, like meditation, you know, in the beginning, you're ready to climb the walls in the first, you know, minute, 30 seconds, but with a little bit of encouragement from yourself, maybe your surroundings, you can have it be a habit and have it be something that you really enjoy doing and isn't so much of a chore. So definitely when we look at ourselves in the beginning, it is more difficult. But like everything, I guess it's like everything. If you practice it, then it gets better and better and easier and easier. So Plato says the same thing. Plato says that people, but in a different way, I like this one. People only act in ways that they perceive will bring them maximum good. I would agree with that. No matter who you are or where you're coming from, you want the best return that's going to happen for you. Is the lack of wisdom that results in the making of a bad choice instead of a prudent one. In this way, wisdom is a central part of virtue. And then he goes on to say that it's, I think it's him, about the common sense. Does he say that? Plato realized that because virtue was synonymous with wisdom, it could be taught, a possibility he had earlier discounted. And then he added correct belief as an alternative to knowledge, proposing that knowledge is merely correct belief that has been thought through and tethered or anchored in oneself. That's what I would say. So, but somebody else does talk about that it's common sense, the same thing that it could be taught. I mean, what's common sense? It's the sense of the common people around you who have realized, hopefully through trials and data collection and conclusions, have chosen the best way to do anything and have taught it to you and the others around you. I mean, that's part of the problem, I think, when the common sense gets a little fucked up, like, you know, living too long under some sort of rule, be it either in your own, in one household or in a government, that is just telling you some cockamamie bullshit for lots of generations, and then it becomes this thing that people do. I mean, I hate to call them out. I mean, and then I'm sure they're different now, but, you know, I got to share the experience. When I went to Albania in 1990, I'm part Albanian, and, you know, wonderful people, some of the most warm and loving people you will ever meet. It's funny. This happens all over the world, right? There are so many wonderful people in these, like, random remote places. But, you know, depending on what the government has done, they can have some really wacky ideas about things. And, you know, being communism fell in 1990, we went there 6 months after it came down, communism came down, and you know, so very fresh in the mind, and, you know, ideas of racism and classism and what does the world look like, because all they saw were, you know, they thought that all Americans were living in Dallas or Dynasty and so many just small hang-ups about things that you know, their government had taught them. So to look at the common sense and the virtue, I think that's an important distinction there is, you know, where is this common sense coming from? Where is this wisdom coming from? I think the only one that you can really trust, it's quite a statement to make, Nicole, the only one you can really trust is your own. Well, yeah, because you're the one that decides how this makes sense to you. So I guess you have to be a thinking person to do that. But, you know, I don't think you're listening here if you're not thinking. So, moving on. And moving from pen paper to the computer. I do go on, I like going back and forth to the pen paper and the just chicka chicka advice for managing your ideas. All right, so who next? Concept, this idea of virtue. The is something that cannot be imposed, but something that is realized and voluntarily lived up to by each individual. What I said, in a way, realized and voluntarily lived up to by each individual. So, it's interesting. Like, when something feels good, there's no questions that go off in your head. You go, all right, then this is what it is. I think we all know that, no matter where we're starting from. We all know what something really true, if we stop to give it a second thought, really feels like. And this is interesting with the Hinduism. For example, Abhastamba explained, whoever that is, fabulous name though, explained virtue and vice do not go about saying, here we are. Neither the gods nor ancestors can convince us that this is right and this is wrong. Virtue is an elusive concept. It demands careful and sustained reflection by every man and woman before it can become part of one's life. That's true. The virtues and the vices don't go, hi, I'm a virtue, and I'm going to be here to be with you, and we're going to do things together. And a vice isn't like, hey, I'm a bad idea. Want to come this way? So, yeah, they don't call out who they are. And it goes back to finding these answers on your own. Even the gods, not the gods nor the ancestors, can convince us what is right and what is wrong. I mean, if we're really thinking, unless we're just sort of going along with what we've been taught and these people know what they're talking about, so I say that. But, you know, again, I don't think that's really what we're talking about. You know, if you've tuned into this show, I think we're going to keep it on a certain level. I'm sure you're right there. So, still looking forward to getting those sound bites so it can be something other than me swallowing. Liquid, that is. So, let's see. Where are we at? Virtue leads to punya, which is holy living in Hindu literature, while vices lead to pap, which is sin. Punya and pap. Interesting. Sometimes the word punya is usually interchangeable with the word virtue. Okay. So then we have the list of virtues necessary for a human being to live a dharmic life. And I'll just list them out. If you want to look up the actual words, they're lovely words, but, you know, to hear me stumble through them, I'm just going to apply that to the rest of our time tonight. So here they are in English, the 10 virtues necessary for a dharmic life. 1, courage. 2, forgiveness. 3, temperance. 4, non-covetous and non-stealing. inner purity, control of senses, reflective prudence, wisdom, truthfulness, free from anger, and then there's a few, five others, nonviolence, self-restraint, non-stealing, inner purity, truthfulness. I think they reduced it down to that. So, you know, don't fight with people. Self-restraint, you know, inner balance, figure out what you're doing and why. Don't take other people's stuff. Inner purity, I think that's about aligning with our own God and aligning what's really going on within us, with our higher source and our power. And truthfulness, don't lie to yourself and don't lie to others. Why? Because that's a road to getting lost. That's the road that ends in brambles and sticky thorns and, you know, and scary noises, really. It's amazing when you watch people who don't tell the truth and are so good at it, you know, can spin this whole life, and maybe you believe them for a while. You're like, wow, yes, whatever you're saying, yes. Because, you know, if it's based in truth, it's very difficult to, if they convince themselves, you know, it becomes the truth until one point or at some, you know, too many things have happened and you go, now, wait a minute, that is not what's happening here. And everybody gets called out and, you know, what do you do when you've spun this as being you? And things that have happened to you, when you get found out, it's a very strange day for that person. They usually, you know, sulk away and hide in the corner. Oh, you're never going to hear from them again. They have no more comments. No comment. Thank you very much. So truthfulness, also with being truthful to yourself. But I think this is interesting because it doesn't mean that you always have to tell the truth, does it? I mean, it's just your truth and knowing why. Like, for instance, a big part of manifestation is telling your story, especially your financial story, in a way that is pleasing to you. And it doesn't necessarily have to be what is, what's happening. It actually, it's better that you don't talk about the things that you don't like and aren't working out for you. So in that case, you're putting yourself on a higher vibration by, you know, not being a documentarian and having to say everything that is exactly happening right now. So I think that's why these things have been talked about and debated for, as you can see, many hundreds, thousands of years. Because just the word itself doesn't really tell you the whole story. Be truthful. All right. Never lie. Well, no. Well, so I can say whatever I want. Well, no. So what does that mean? Well, I think that's the blanket of virtue, isn't it? You got to find it for yourself. So here's a few more. Page down. Okay. Well, Buddhism is kind of self-explanatory if you know anything about Buddhism. I don't know. I figured I would kind of blah, blah, blah through them only because, this is horrible to say, but only because I've known them for I've studied them for so long. And if you're really interested in them, it takes more than just the words. Maybe that's why, you know, Buddhism is so great because you can't really attach to any kind of concept. It's kind of like, it's this. Well, what do you mean? Yeah, just, you know, that. So for instance, you have the Noble Eightfold Path, which can be seen as a list of virtues in Buddhism. The one is right view, which is realizing the Four Noble Truths. That's a good thing to look up, the Four Noble Truths. A lot of people have talked about that. Right mindfulness, mental ability to see things for what they are with a clear conscience. Right concentration, wholesome one-pointedness of mind. And then, you know, loving kindness towards others, the hope that other people will be well, that all sentient beings, without exception, will be happy. That's a big one in Buddhism. Karuna, compassion, the hope that a person suffering will diminish. Compassion is the wish for all sentient beings to be free from suffering. The Dalai Lama opened for the U.S. Senate, Congress, maybe it was Congress, I don't remember. They're all kind of the same to me. He said, you know, without exception, that all sentient beings can be happy and to have compassion for all of them. And if you watch it, you can look it up. You know, Dalai Lama opens for the U.S., whatever, it'll tell you what it is. I'm sure he hasn't been to a lot of them. The vibe in the room is just so like, you know, I'm sure there are people that agree with him. And I was like, you know, what if I was like that douchebag, pick one, who's, you know, just relying on money and lobbying and greed, listening to the Dalai Lama must be like, what are they thinking? Are they just like, yeah, whatever, fuck them all? Like, what's the inner dialogue there? Wouldn't it be great if we could put a microphone to each one of their heads? See what's really going on? How about that? How about that for the people's NSA? to be able to listen to the thoughts of our leaders. No misstep in there, huh? Be like, oh my God, that guy's a douchebag. Get rid of him. Anyway, so we have, what else? Mudita, altruistic joy in the accomplishments of a person, oneself or other, because, you know, we're all the oneness. We're all same thing. So just joy for accomplishments that happens to a human person, something. Sympathetic joy is the wholesome attitude of rejoicing in the happiness and virtues of all sentient beings. They make sure to put that in. Everyone is included in this. And then we have Upekkha with two K's, or Upeksha. Nice. I like these words. I see why a lot of people say them. I mean, we should keep them intact, right? But sometimes they just kind of muck up the conversation. Pick the language you're speaking, say it in that. Okay. Upeksha means equanimity, or learning to accept both loss and gain, praise and blame, success and failure without detachment, equally for oneself and for others. Ah, isn't that a wonderful way to live? To accept both loss and gain, praise and blame, success and failure, without detachment, or with detachment, equally for yourself and others. It's great. I mean, that really is that nice, you know, being at one with everything that is. And, okay, this too is happening, this too shall pass, kind of a mentality. Always a good idea. I mean, how can you argue with that? Equanimity means not to distinguish between friend. It means not to distinguish between friend, enemy, or stranger, but to regard every sentient being as equal. Yes. It is a clear-minded, tranquil state of mind, not being overpowered by delusions, mental dullness, or agitation. Mental dullness. Wow. Benjamin Franklin talked about this dullness. We'll get to him in a minute. Or agitation. Yeah, because all those things, you know, make you come from a totally different point of view. Delusion, you're lying to yourself. So you're over here, you know, you're playing tennis while the rest of the team is over here bowling. Like, you know, your rules are not going to apply to what's really happening here. And the mental dullness is just kind of like a big dullness, isn't it? It's just sort of a going on. They're like, no. And, or agitation, coming from an angry place. Well, then everything is fueled by the fire, isn't it? So, and then we have the Taoism. When I was looking at these, the next one is Confucius. I was like, oh, yes, let's see what Confucius have to say. Very nice. In Confucianism, moral manifestations of virtue include Ren, R-E-N, which means humanity and goodness, Xiao. I don't know how to say that. X-I-A-O. It's like chow, but with an X. Filial piety. And Li, proper behavior and performance of rituals. Isn't that interesting? Confucius thought that to be virtuous, you must have rituals in there. And I think we're learning these days how important ritual is, even if it is just your... Just. It's one of the greatest things you can do for yourself. Have a wonderful morning ritual of cleaning yourself, cleaning your mind, and preparing yourself for a beautiful, light and love-filled day. And, you know, that it works. Ooh, I started using the Money and the Law of Attraction cards by Abraham Hicks. And I'll read one at the end that I think is very fitting to this topic. But they're so great. I mean, I had this inkling to buy them, and so I bought them. But I looked and I was like, oh, yeah, okay, money, law of attraction. Yeah, yeah, great idea. But never really. I was like, how do these work? What do you do with them? They sat on the shelf for about 4 months. And then they started to call to me like any good thing does. You know, you just get it. And when you're ready, you'll go, ooh, I got to look at this again. And so I picked them up again, and they're great. All they are is about 45 different cards. They all have a very simple yet very powerful picture on the front and a sentence. And all you do is you look at the card, you look at the picture, and then you turn it over and read the back. And it's not, you don't have to have any kind of divining, any kind of intuition or psychicness. It's none of that. Any one of them applies to any moment in any situation. And the point of them is to raise your vibration to a level where you are giving a positive vibration about money and the law of attraction. And of course, because money is very synonymous with freedom for a lot of us, for everyone, really. I mean, you can decide to have freedom without it, but, you know, it's in the mix. That to free ourselves, we need to embrace it just like any other love. Any other thing that we want to attract is to be on the right level with it. So they're so great. And so I've been picking one, two, three, whatever I feel like a day, and then I leave them on the side and I pick them up, you know, maybe a few more times. And then when I feel like I got those, I move on to another few, and I'll just continue to do this and run through the pack until, you know, until I decide to stop. So there you go. Hi, Gia. Nice to see you. I love your pictures lately. You look so beautiful in your colorful, colorful dresses. Lovely, lovely soul. So lovely to have you. So yeah. Okay. So Confucius said, you must take a sip up drink. Okay. The Taoist concept of de, D-E, is the ability of an individual to follow the way. Okay, fine. One important normative value in much of Chinese thinking is that one's social status should result from the amount of virtue that one demonstrates rather than from one's birth. I thought that was interesting. I got this from Wikipedia, and definitely simplified it and kind of chopped it down. But I didn't know that that was a Chinese normative value. I thought they kind of had, maybe they just have a girl thing, you know, better to have a boy. Hopefully they're moving past that these days. But anyway, Confucius explains de as he who exercises government by means of his virtue, may be compared to the North Polar Star, which keeps its place and all the stars turn towards it. Interesting. I just realized that when he says exercises government, it's kind of like governing our own self, but, you know, you can definitely apply it to the government. Imagine if our government were some of the smartest, most morally excellent people, virtuous people, freedom-minded people. Imagine if they were the ones that were guiding us and leading us. So it's a wonderful place to to intuit, to pontificate on, you know, to fantasize about, because that's how we get things done with the law of attraction, thinking about what we do want. So, and then this was interesting with the samurais. The samurai on virtue, Yamamoto, his views on virtue in the four vows he makes daily. When I was reading this, I really wanted to read it in like some Asian accent. Never to be outdone in the way of the samurai or Bushido. So hardcore. I love it. I feel like I was a samurai in a past life. Anyway, to be good of good use to the master, to be filial to my parents, to manifest great compassion and act for the sake of man. Yamamoto goes on to say, if one dedicates these four vows to the gods and Buddhas every morning, he will have the strength of two men and never slip backward. One must edge forward like inchworm, bit by bit. The gods and Buddhas, too, first started with this vow. So the Bushido code is typified by seven virtues: rectitude, courage, benevolence, respect, honesty, honor, loyalty, and then they sometimes add the piety, wisdom, and care for the aged. Care for older people. Isn't that wonderful? That's part of the way of the samurai. Isn't that cool? It's amazing how when you do a little research, just pick a topic and look around. Very interesting. Find a lot of stuff. Thanks to that World Wide Web that we have. So, and then I think this is, oh, yeah, two more guys, but I wouldn't go through it if it wasn't interesting, at least to me. Nietzsche promotes the virtues of those he calls higher men, people like Beethoven. The virtues he praises in them are creative powers, the men of great creativity, the really great men, according to my understanding. So obviously, I mean, everywhere that it says men, obviously we can put in women as well, about great creativity. And also he talks about being alone, that solitude is a great product of virtue. So according to Nietzsche, these higher types are solitary, pursuing a unified project, revere themselves and are healthy and life-affirming. Because mixing with the herd makes one base, the higher type strives instinctively for a citadel and a secrecy where he is saved from the crowd, the many, the great majority. Interesting, isn't it? The higher type also instinctively seeks heavy responsibilities in the form of an organizing idea for their life, which drives them to artistic and creative work and gives them psychological health and strength. The fact that the higher types are healthy, for Nietzsche, does not refer to physical health as much as the psychological resilience and fortitude. Finally, a higher type affirms life because he is willing to accept the eternal return of his life and affirm this forever and unconditionally. So there you go. If you're spending any time alone right now, if you're not enjoying it, you definitely should. If you are enjoying it, know that you're doing some of the greatest work for yourself. I mean, I spend a lot of time by myself. Sometimes I think, you know, I feel like the mad scientist in the tower, but you know, when there are people around, you don't spend hours and hours on the internet looking at what people have to say about virtue and, or write a song or paint a painting. You know, it's a solitary thing. But again, to expand this idea of what it means to be solitary, I find that the more time that I enjoy my solitary time, the more that I can connect with spirit, and I realize that there's plenty around me. There's plenty that enjoy my interaction with myself, and I enjoy my interaction with myself that much more. So I thought it was cool that Nietzsche was down with the alone time. Can relate to that. And then also the higher type affirms life because he is willing to accept the eternal return of his life and affirm this forever and unconditionally. I think this is an accepting of the oneness with God that we are, understanding why we're here. Kind of all ties in, don't you think? Pretty quiet tonight. Do you feel like you're at a lecture? I was wondering if it would feel like that. But anyway, this is what came up. So, all right. So to sum up Nietzsche's four virtues, we have courage, insight, sympathy, and solitude. Because solitude is a virtue for us, because it is a sublime inclination and an impulse to cleanliness, which again, I think can be taken the wrong way, but that cleanliness with self that, she said, Gia says, no, I'm trying to be quiet. I of course have stuff to say. Oh, it's funny. The balance, right? We all have to find the balance. Well, I feel like I'm doing a lot of talking today, but there's so many notes. Anyway, the cleanliness, I think, you know, it's finding that golden mean of cleanliness, obviously, of coming from a place of source and calm well-being. So, and then he kind of talks about, you know, being around people can make us unclean, like what shows... which shows that contact between people, society, inevitably make things unclean. Somewhere, sometime, every community makes people base, which, I don't know, I mean, you know, all these philosophers, they can get out some nice sound bites, and then sometimes you're just like, what? But I understand what he's saying, you know, if you're hanging out with, you know, Honey Boo Boo, and that's your community, and, or, you know, it doesn't even have to be that extreme. Yeah, you know, if that's your only choice, then definitely go be alone. But I think nowadays there's plenty of people to hang out with, even remotely like this, through radio and listener. Pretty cool. Anyway, let's see. So the last thing on Nietzsche is genuine honesty, assuming that this is our virtue. And we cannot get rid of it. He's talking about truthfulness and honesty. Well, then, we will want to work on it with all the love and malice at our disposal and not get tired of perfecting ourselves in our virtue, the only one we have left. May its glory come to rest like a gilded blue evening glow of mockery over this aging culture and its dull and dismal seriousness. I forget when Nietzsche was living, but good Lord, seems like he was having quite a time, wasn't he? I mean, you know, you got to think about where they're writing from and the times that they're coming from. So, and the last one that I'll go into, I can't believe I've been talking for 40 minutes about this. Amazing. Is Benjamin Franklin, because I'm a big fan. I'm from Philadelphia. And I just love the fact that this guy was a diplomat and an inventor and a ladies' man, and apparently probably a stand-up comedian in a sense, and, you know, helped us with a lot of things with, you know, smoothing over relations with France when no one else could do it. France is freaking out, and Benjamin Franklin's like, oh, I'll go hang out with, you know, the dames. It'll be fine. Just don't do anything too stupid, America. So, anyway, this is what Benjamin Franklin said about virtues. He called them moral perfection. He had a checklist in a notebook to measure each day how he lived up to his virtues. So here we go. Temperance. Eat not to dullness. Drink not to elevation. I mean, I wonder how many times he got that one done. Because, you know, he was quite the drinker and quite the partier, but, you know, it's a nice thing to have in your checklist. Silence, something I know nothing about today. Silence. Speak not but what may benefit others or yourself. Avoid trifling conversation. Ah, yes. Dulls the mind, doesn't it? Order. Let all your things have their places. Let each part of your business have its time. It's nice. I like that. That makes for a clean brain when everything has its place. Resolution. Resolve to perform what you ought. Perform without fail what you resolve. That's good. Again, remember the checklist. You know, Benjamin Franklin, and no one is doing this every day, but, you know, when you can, it's great. Frugality. Make no expense but to do good to others or yourself. Waste nothing. Industry. Lose no time. Be always employed in something useful. Cut off all unnecessary actions. Sincerity. Use no hurtful deceit. Think innocently and justly. And if you speak, speak accordingly. Justice. Wrong none, but by doing injuries or omitting the benefits that are your duty. I'm not really sure what he means by benefits there, but anyway. Avoid extremes. Oh, this one's moderation. Avoid extremes. Forbear resenting injuries so much as you think they deserve. Cleanliness. Tolerate no uncleanliness in body, clothes, or habituation. Habitation, sorry. You know, those days, it was a very good idea to keep clean, huh? Always a good idea to keep clean, Nicole. Tranquility. Be not disturbed at trifles or at accidents common or unavoidable. That's a good one, isn't it? Serenity now. Serenity now. Gear wrote bed bugs for real. I mean, yes, always the cleanliness. And then chastity, which, if you know anything about Benjamin Franklin, was not really a strong point, but listen to how he puts it. Rarely use venery, which means sexual indulgence, but for health or offspring, never to dullness, weakness, or the injury of your own or another's peace or reputation. I really like that. Because it shows, you know, always have respect for the person that you're laying with. And, you know, peace of mind, dullness, cleanliness, good idea. And then the last one is humility. And all he writes is, imitate Jesus and Socrates. So figure it out, yo. Humility, Jesus, Socrates. Apunto. That's great. All right, Gia finally had something to say. Let's see. I am in a rift between my goals, Gwen's potions, ooh, menopause, ooh, and global consciousness, ooh. No wonder it's a rift. And ancestral empathy. Ah, interesting. Suppose I have some difficult Cirque du Soleil kinds of episodes to create. Wow, Gio, what an interesting time. Definitely a full plate menagerie you have going on there. I mean, I think we're all juggling this. I mean, at least I can very much relate. Most people around me, men and women, straight and gay, can relate to this amount of, you know, working with the seen, unseen, whatever's going on with your body, and then the global energies and the consciousness. So, yeah, I mean, and also this whole thing with women, it brings me into virtue and women, because this was very interesting. And this has come up a lot since I decided to do this topic of women as being property. So because I was thinking about virtue and women's chastity and how in like watching in the 15th, 16th century before and beyond, how women's virginity really set the tone for her entire life. I mean, having one moment of sexual passion, you could be fucked. You could be fucked. Amazing. because then you can't marry a nobleman. You can't marry, I mean, depending on who you are, you can't marry royalty anyway. I mean, you know, whatever, say what you want about those things. But still, you know, you're trying to have a good life for yourself in a time when women weren't allowed to have all the opportunities for work and prosperity the way that men did. So, and just the fact that, you know, having sex, the 15 minutes could change your whole thing around. This is when I talked to my mother about it, but let me set it up here with women as property. The Married Woman's Property Act of 1870. This is when this stopped women's property from being confiscated basically by their husband. Before 1870, any money made by a woman, either through a wage from an investment, by gift or through inheritance, automatically became the property of her husband once she was married. Once a woman became married, her property was no longer her own, and her husband could choose to dispose of it whenever he thought suitable. Thus, a woman on marrying relinquished her personal property to her husband's ownership. By law, he was permitted to dispose of it at will at any time, and even after death, he, you know, could have control of it. And married women had very few legal rights and were not recognized as being separate legal beings, which the term for that was a femme sole or a woman alone. In contrast, a single and widowed woman were considered in common law to be femme soles, and they already had their right to own property in their own name. Isn't that interesting? So a woman alone, they had the legal right to live where they pleased and to support themselves in any occupation that did not require a license or a college degree restricted to males, which, you know, was very little, very little opportunity. A lot of times it ended up in a dirty, dark factory for 14 hours until they said, oh, women can't work more than 10 hours. And then there was all kinds of, you know, that went wrong with that. But anyway, look it up if you're interested. Single woman could enter into contracts, buy and sell real estate, accumulate personal property. So as long as they remained unmarried, women could sue, be sued, write wills, serve as guardians, and act as executors of estates. So isn't that interesting? That, oh, and here's this guy, an English jurist, William Blackstone, famously put it in his commentaries on English law from 1765, 1769. By marriage, the husband and wife are one person in the law. That is, the very being or legal existence of the woman is suspended during the marriage. She kind of like floats. She's like no longer a human being. Amazing. During the marriage, or at least is incorporated and consolidated into that of the husband, under whose wing, protection and cover, she performs everything. Oh my. LOL is right, Gia. I mean, good Lord. That's where the pool boy came in. I mean, honestly, like you can see. Incredible. So when we think about, you know, this idea of virtue versus freedom, you have to think about women, don't you? I mean, we're supposed to have had, you know, this virtue, this chastity, this prudence, this cleanliness, this, all of this. And yet, if you actually join with a man, it almost seems like the man is the one. It's just a terrible idea. You know, now you're dirty. You're if your husband dies, you're a widow and you're sort of like, you know, used goods. I mean, it's like a no-win situation. And so I bring this up because, you know, here we are learning how to have these freedoms and these equalities for everybody, straight, gay, black, white, any color you are, women, I mean, we're all going through nation upon nation. I mean, Ukraine and Russia. So it's all coming up. And so I point this out so that women can see, like, where we're coming from here. And, you know, what was happening? 1870, this stopped. 1870. So I was looking for when did women start becoming properties, and Google had nothing for me. So I instead called my mother. I mean, there was, like, no straight answer as to when did women start becoming properties. Like, when did this all start? Well, no, nothing. Try it. Google it. Word it however you want. No answer. And so I called my mother. And I was like, you know, when would you say that women became property? And she said they were always property. I mean, their father married them off. He paid for her with the dowry, property of the family, of the husband, of the church. And then she said, you don't know how good you have it, that you can choose. I mean, she's right. You know, I mean, well, all of us can see how much better we have it. I mean, you know, the fact that you're listening to me right now, you know, it's not the 1500s. We're not waiting for a month piecemeal. So, you know, but good Lord, amazing. I mean, this has just been going on. I think, honestly, that there was, you know, before we decided to record this time, like we've done, you know, with the patriarchy, that there was, I think we were in charge as women, and, you know, gave over the power, and then this is what they've done with it, the patriarchy. So, and then my mother went on to point out that men were written about being virtuous, not so much women, and that they really had no job that was going to be, you know, really actually lucrative. If you were a single woman, she said, get married or be a prostitute. That was it. I mean, of course, there were some jobs, but yeah, I mean, amazing. And then the virginity thing, she was saying that it was actually for the woman's favor because, you know, although then you have a baby or you're raped or you're shunned by your community, you know, until the pill or any kind of contraception, you know, the chastity and the virginity was a good thing for a woman to keep intact. But again, you know, the freedom, like freedom of expression, freedom of the sexuality. Interesting. So the last point on that is the fact that single women had rights and the married women didn't. So why? Why were women allowed to have rights when they were not married? Because the state didn't want to have to care for them. There's no man around, so all right, do it yourself. But, you know, not too much. So when they needed it done, we did it. But, you know, you can't have any kind of equality or any kind of, you know, being equal to us, you know. Oh, my God, that's so funny, Gia. I passed over that part. She wrote, there was a whole thing about no blood on the white wedding sheets. That's exactly what my mother said. She said, you know, blood on the sheets for marriage. They were checked to see if there was, you know, you broke the hymen. And sometimes there was no blood. She said, sometimes, you know, he would cut his finger, you know, to save her and go, yeah, yeah, there was blood. Save her chastity, her cleanliness, her virtue. Amazing. Amazing. Ah. So anyway, I'm bringing this to you because I was just... It's incredible. And then this idea of a virgin, you know, Christianity put women on a pedestal because of Mary. The virgin, which really was a misinterpretation, it was really the maiden, the young girl, the virtuous, the pure, but pure, not necessarily sexually being touched. I mean, come on, no man's an island, no woman's an island. But you know what I mean? It's the maiden. It's the beautiful love goddess. You know, that was the idea of the virgin. Then it got hijacked. And then the last thing my mother said was, you know, these men put their women on the pedestal, and then what? Sometimes they didn't even want her anymore. She's just sitting up there. She's too high up on the pedestal. You can't touch her anywhere. You got to go to a prostitute. Amazing. So, in defense of history. In the ancient world, apparently in Egypt, women had virtually the same rights as men, they could own property and they could sign contracts. And there was the pharaoh Hatshepsut. I'm actually a big fan of hers, but to me it looks like Hatshepsut. So she became a pharaoh, and she wore the pharaoh's beard, which the false beard, which is called the postiche, which was a sign of sovereignty from the god Osiris, apparently appeared in a number of art pieces with a grand beard of his own, which appeared to be synthetic. So then real life pharaohs started putting them all on. And so she decided, you know, if I'm going to be the pharaoh, then let's go with the false beard. And apparently she was a very prosperous and very effective ruler. Her reign was peaceful. She defended her borders. She had lucrative trade expeditions, and she remodeled the great temple of Karnak. And then when she died, the subsequent rulers did their best to demolish her statues and erase her from the historical records. So that happened, but, you know, thankfully you can only bury things so far until we find them again. And then Saxon women had some freedoms, whereas I guess with the Saxons, both men and women could be slaves, and Viking women also had a good deal of freedom, which is pretty cool. And they were saying, you know, in the Middle Ages, everybody had to work hard, so nobody could really survive without the other. So they said most men could not run a farm or a business without their wife's help. So, you know, isn't that the point? They had it right in the Middle Ages, right, to work together. Good Lord. All right, so I'm going to take a break with talking for a second, and then we'll go a little bit into freedom. Amazing, the virtue took an hour. Yeah, we're going to go with Abraham. If it feels good, it's right. And I just need to set up the story for you. So it's about 5 minutes that I'll play out of a 16-minute thing. Talking about a story of a mother. The mother came up to Abraham, was asking questions that you know, she wasn't getting along with her son. And she said something about, you know, she went on mommy's son dinner night. And Abraham was like, what is that? It's the most disturbing thing I've ever heard. What is mommy's son night? And, you know, she said, oh, it's for us to get together. And Abraham said, did it seem like he wanted to be there? And the woman said, apparently not. And Abraham was like, apparently not. I mean, I guess he was like being passive aggressive and walking in front of her. You know, he's like a teenage son. He doesn't want to be with his mother. So anyway, she transitions into talking about being from a parent's perspective, as well as, you know, being someone's child perspective. We can all have that, you know, we're all someone's child and we may be someone's parent. So, and then it's basically about freedom for yourself and others and what everybody really wants to do and having respect for that, especially yourself and your inner guidance system. So, 5 minutes of Abraham. Ba, ba, ba.
Demonstrate your awareness that there is a broader part of you that is calling you, and demonstrate your awareness that you can deliberately get into alignment and then leave them to their own experience, because we promise you, they do not want to feel bad. Your children don't want to feel bad and know in most cases much better than their parents how to keep themselves feeling good. But parents who have lived longer and therefore are more disconnected than their children still believe that they must sort out all of the conditions and come to the rightnesses and the wrongnesses of the world. In other words, parents are, for the most part, still very much trying to control conditions where the youngsters are more intuitively closing their own vibrational gap. That's the war that is going on predominantly between parents and children. Parents think that they got here first and therefore they know more, and children know that they got here later, therefore they've forgotten less. And so what could be better than a parent who is now remembering and a child who hasn't forgotten? In other words, isn't that wonderful when you come together and you all come to the same conclusion? I care about how I feel, and I can do something about how I feel. And your daughter or government or country or issue or circumstance or event, you do not have to change in order for me to feel better. In fact, I've given myself freedom, freedom in the only way freedom can come. I've given myself the freedom of alignment because my alignment is exclusive of anything that you are doing. That's the only place you'll ever get freedom. If your happiness depends upon what anyone else does, you're in deep doo-doo. Because you can't align your perspective. And so people spend lifetimes, look at the centuries of war that goes on in regions around the world as you are determined to convince others that your idea is the right one. They are so scrambled, they can't even figure out what they want now. Most people are so much more aware of what they don't want, they can't get into alignment with who they are. And in their pain at not being in alignment, they're sure that it's somebody else's fault. It is the truest picture of bondage to separate yourself from source and then think somebody else has done it and ask them to do something to get you back in alignment when they don't have the power to do it. And that's what these kids are trying to tell you. Parent, mother, I love you so much. Dad, I love you so much. But I can't do it your way because you're outside of my guidance system. I can't consider everything that you're saying and close my gap. You've got a different set of rules going on. Can you imagine if Magellan, the navigational system in one of Jerry Nestor's vehicles, tried to be really helpful and overlaid 10 maps, 10 different maps of 10 different people and where they are and 10 different destinations and said, here, this may help. It would just cause absolute chaos because the only thing that matters is where I am in relationship to where I want to be, and my emotion is guiding me there. But if I have to factor in what mom did when she was my age and what whoever set up the stupid mother-daughter party thinks about it all and what the religion thinks about it, not this one, not only this one, but that one and 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 that one. You just drive yourselves out of your minds by trying to factor in what everybody thinks about something that hasn't got anything to do with them while you distract yourself from everything that does have to do with you, you see. So next time your son invites you someplace, say, do you really want to go? Is this something you want to do, or is this something that somebody else thinks is a good idea for us to do? And having had that experience, now you know that, you see. Don't you? Isn't it just so interesting to do something because somebody else wants you to do it, and then you get in the middle of it and you just hate it, and now you have to keep pretending that you don't hate it because you don't want to hurt their feelings, but you're not lined up, and so you're not having a good time, which makes you lousy company, and then they're not having a good time, and then they feel bad for inviting you because they're not having a good time either, and then you say, well, we have done our responsible thing. We did something that somebody else wanted us to do in order to prove something that they needed to prove, and all we ended up with proving was that we hated being here. And then we say, well, just keep paddling upstream and giving each other trophies about how many mother-son-daughter or mother and son dinners you can endure. And we say, our idea of going with the flow is saying, someone invites you to something and your first response to it will give you a reading on whether you really want to go or not. And if you will do nothing out of obligation and responsibility and everything because you can feel that your inner being is calling you toward it, you will never again be in a situation where you will be eliciting from someone something less than who they really are. You must be selfish. You must be selfish enough to care how you feel to be of a whit of value to anyone else. So if you do something out of obligation and you don't feel good about doing, you've helped no one. If you do something out of responsibility, even though you don't want to do it, you've helped no one. People say, well, Abraham, if none of us did anything that we don't want to do, the first thing that happened would no one would go to work. And then what? And we say, you'd figure out another way. You'd figure out another way. You'd be a healthier society on the day that you stopped doing anything that didn't feel good when you do it. And eventually, you'd start to sort things out. Now, humans always want to take it to the very extreme. In other words, we're not encouraging you from your place of greatest disconnection to stop doing the things that you've been doing that have been making your life work to a certain extent. It would get a bit chaotic at first. But we're saying if you can start lining up energy, lining up energy, lining up energy, worrying about closing the gap, giving your attention to closing the gap, coming into alignment with who you are so that your inspiration is the basis for your action, what you would begin to notice is all of the things that you are not taking pleasure from doing would move out of your life experience. If you can be one who does only that which makes you feel good. So now, how would, if we'd met you on the first day of your experience, this would all be easier.
Okay. So then she talks about if she met with the parents and the child, you know, on the first day of the experience, you know, to be able to bridge the gap that much better. But isn't that great? I mean, to be able to, that's freedom to me, combined with virtue, is listening to your inner guidance and figuring out what you enjoy doing and then doing that and not doing anything out of obligation. The freedom to not have to go and stand like a soldier, you know, and salute to something that you don't believe in. You know, those are the freedoms that we're looking to have. And when we think about freedom, it's funny. I looked up freedom on the big box, and it was an interesting Wikipedia post. It was the first post that I had ever seen that were just lists. It was just lists. This is what freedom means. To Wikipedia, but, you know, and then each one were links you could read more about it. But here's the list. It really expands on the idea of freedom. Freedom is free will, liberty, rights, civil liberties, political freedom, freedom of assembly, so you can get together and talk with your peeps about whatever you want. Freedom of association, I can hang out with whoever I want. Freedom of choice, freedom of speech, economic freedom, moral responsibility. We get back to the Benjamin Franklin there. Academic freedom, I can learn whatever I want. Some women in the Middle East could definitely use that. Intellectual freedom, I can think whatever I want. How many people have been jailed for thinking against what whoever's in power is thinking? Scientific freedom. You know, how many people were beheaded by, say, who was it that was you know, shunned or even killed? I don't remember, for saying that that everything revolves around the sun and not us. And then autonomy, as one who gives oneself their own law. Which I think Pinko the bear would relate with. That's kind of along the lines of anarchy and communism, right? Govern yourself, one who gives oneself their own law. But how do you give yourself your own law? I mean, I was talking with my friend Jamie about Copernicus. Thank you, Gwen. And hello, Gwen. Thank you for joining. I was talking with my friend Jamie about freedom, and he was like, you know, he was like, I think freedom is kind of an overrated word. Freedom for who? Freedom to kill? Freedom to embezzle? Freedom for hedge funds and lobbyists to take everything? You know, freedom to spy on everybody? Freedom to make drones? I mean, like, who's freedom here? But I think that's why virtue is very important to follow close with freedom, because you know, it has to come from some sort of anchored, as who was it, Plato or somebody said, a tethered place, something that's anchored in ourselves, so that the freedom comes from a place of well-being, a place of good for all, a place of compassion, and, you know, the Buddhist Four Noble Truths. So, and then self-determination was the last one, self-determination. I looked that one up. Self-determination is the idea of a positive freedom, a freedom for actions that we originate and that actions are up to us, quote unquote. Such acts constitute the essence of free will. Interesting. It's kind of what we're all about here. Self-determined. Yes, Gwen. Self-determination and that it is up to us, taking responsibility for what happens to us, knowing that we are the center of our own universe and part of a one, all makes sense. And then it gets a little more with Mortimer Adler's term, translating ideas from Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas. Determination. Okay, well, Gwen said the word, so let's continue with it. The technical terms determination and adequate determinism have been proposed as preferable to determinism to describe actions that are adequately determined by an agent's current reasons, motives, and desires, as opposed to the strict predeterminism by a causal chain of effects going back before the agent's birth. Woo, mama. I did so much editing when I cut and pasted what I liked from Wikipedia, and I was like, is this part of the way that they give us the information? Like, it would be so much easier if they just cut it down. I guess that's just editing. But sometimes, you know, the message gets lost in all of this, you know, mumbo jumbo. So what does that really mean, determination? I think it means the same thing. You know, where you're coming from, what are your motives, what are your desires? Are you coming from a place of agitation, jealousy, greed, or are you coming from, you know, a place of peace, calm, light, and love? So, yeah, I know I can edit them, but I think it's kind of like a epidemic thing. I think, you know, free the words, but whatever. I found it actually easier when I cut and pasted it, and then I just chopped it down. I got the message much easier, so... So this idea of freedom, and also bringing it back down to spirit therapy for the last 13 minutes, it's what do we do with our own mind? What is our freedom within our own mind and within our own actions, being in our own virtue? I mean, I think if you're listening, I know Gia and Gwen are right on this page, but... You know, our virtue is, whether we know it or not, it's really something that we're working on every day. It's the things that we post on Facebook, the things that we bring out to the world and what we think are important, and also operating from a place of integrity and having prosperity, but not for the detriment of others, for continuing in the community. So, you know, the virtues, I think if you're coming from a place of love and light, you are working on your virtues and you are looking to be courageous and make the most of your solitude time and have compassion and these things. So how does this evolve into our freedom? Our freedom with the way that we think with ourselves. Like, for instance, I've seen that more and more I talk to myself out loud, and part of it also is helping me to connect with spirit. I feel like I'm having a conversation. And I remember our Gwen and my good friend Asa, who was born tapped in, was always in a dialogue with spirit. You know, he's like, yeah, they're right there. And this is something I've always wanted to do. But I find when you're talking out loud, I don't know, it helps. But of course, you know, the freedom to do that, it's like, well, you know, don't do it too much or else you might be crazy or you might start to sound crazy or you might start to lose your way. I mean, these are things that, like, I would say to myself, and, you know, I think of myself as a freedom-oriented person. But I realized, you know, freeing myself from these ideas that I've had was very helpful. So like, where do you let your mind wander to? I mean, think about Einstein. I talked about it last week about how he came up with the theory of relativity. I mean, he was, you know, Einstein was the fuck up. His father was very disappointed. He wanted him to be a doctor. And, you know, he went to his first operating room, and, you know, he was just like, oh, my God, this is so barbaric. I can't do this. There's too much blood and guts. And then he got a job at a patent now office, and he was, you know, bored. He's Einstein. So he's staring out the window, and he's watching people run for buses and comes up with the theory of relativity. So, you know, to let your mind wander, fascinating, and also to trust what your mind is doing. The decisions that come up. I mean, I have to say, that's one thing that I'm really enjoying with this ride, with this radio show, is just following the instinct of what I go, ooh, that might be a cool show. Well, what are you going to say? I ask myself. Well, I'm like, I don't know. But we'll figure it out. If we've got 4 days, great. However long, you know, it comes when it comes. So the trusting of that, trusting of the freedom of how your mind works, you know, what you let it do, what you let yourself think about, and what is freedom of mind? Putting yourself out of the box. Interesting. I mean, just sort of saying those words, just contemplating that, I think kind of gets your brain out of the box. When I was doing my research, I was listening to classical music, and, you know, more and more, it gets proven to me that classical music is one of the highest forms of vibration. And it's hours flew by. I mean, it kept me tuned in, as Abraham says, tuned in, tapped in, turned on. I guess I just realized that that's where I was, because hours flew by and I was just, you know, in it. Oh, wow. What does Confucius say? And just a side note, you know, when you listen to Pandora and you tell it a little bit of what you like and what you don't like, it follows your rhythms. Did you know that we all have we have notes and rhythms and timings that we gravitate towards? So when we tell it, we like this, we don't like that, It gets our number. It understands what you want. And you go, ooh, this is a great song. Oh, I like that. Ooh, isn't that nice? How did it know? Well, it knew because you're very predictable. Isn't that amazing? So, but also it's kind of an interesting way of law of attraction. You know, it's like it's bringing more of what I'm wanting, what I'm liking. So kind of a cool thing to work on your attractability. Just put, and but don't tell it too much. Word to the wise on Pandora. You can't direct it too much because it's still a machine. Like, it doesn't understand. You're just rooting it on. It thinks that if you keep liking the same kind of songs for too long, you're going to get all the same songs and you're going to go, why am I so bored? Well, because it thought, you know, you put yourself in too small of a box. You got to kind of give it, just guide it a little bit, and then just let it ride. Let it come up with whatever. Don't then become more interesting. Not that enough with your whining guitar, you know, that kind of thing. So, that's why I'm happy. That's what Gwen just wrote in. That song has been flying around. There's one where these, I don't know, grade school kids, they all have their awesome uniforms. The girls have, like, their white tights. And they're all acting out the happy and singing it together, like, choral style. Amazing. I mean, I think that's one of the greatest benefits of freedom of thought and acting in your virtue, is those kinds of creations. I mean, how did Pharrell come up with that? It's a simple song. It's very simple. Right, it's the same thing, but the word, you know, clap along if you think that happiness is the truth. I mean, that's all I needed to hear. I was like, I love this song. This is the shiznit. So, you know, but he had to have some sort of freedom of thought and also not judge what the things were that were coming out. I mean, be like, oh, is this too simple? I mean, I say that all the time. It's got to be, you know, very complicated when coming up with music. But then sometimes it's all you can do is the simple thing. But then a lot of times that's all you really need is the simple thing. So, yeah, like a great, great song like Happy. So, oh, wow. You guys are typing stuff in a peacock box. I put all my stuff in a peacock box, Gia says. It may be making me go insane. What's a peacock box? that's hilarious. all right. Well, ladies, thank you so much for hanging out with me. This has been really wonderful. And thank you all for who are going to listen in the archive. I guess I got to wrap it up. It's 5 minutes. Amazing. Am I really going to go into a Pinko and the Bear and do a 2 hours? Who knows? If I keep picking these gigantic topics, then maybe. But anyway, but I'd like to close with the card that I picked from the Money and Law of Attraction card pile. It's number 31, which I know is a very special number. And it's a picture of two hands. One has a flower in it, and one has sort of the leaves and vines in it. And the sentence is, I can have money and freedom too. A feeling of being overwhelmed is your indicator that you are denying yourself access to all manner of cooperation that could assist you if you were not disallowing it. As you begin to feel freer regarding the expenditure of time and money, doors will open. People will come to assist you. Refreshing and productive ideas will occur to you, and circumstances and events will unfold. As you change the way you feel, you access the energy that creates worlds. It is there for your ready access at all times. So I'll leave you with that. Have beautiful freedom in your mind, freedom of your money flow, and freedom in your virtue to be whoever you are. And go, women, rah-rah. It is the time of the Black Moon Lilith that is coming around and making some sort of major configuration with the retrograde Venus and retrograde Mars, which signify the male and the female and all that come with them. And the Black Moon Lilith is the dark, under, repressed, aggressive, you know, other, the dark witch female that no matter if you're male or female, you are going to either come into contact with or need to make peace within yourself. So, you know, freedom of who you are, freedom of expression. And yes, thank you for all the love, ladies. I see flowers and happy faces and jumping smelly faces with one tooth. That's hilarious. All right. Peace and love, everyone. I will see you next week. Have a great one. And yeah, love, peace, freedom, and virtue. And go Edward Snowden. Good night.